for some time. Is that correct? Under a minute, please.
Yeah, that's correct. I think all China and even Russia represent an alternative to the West that doesn't strap them with such coercion and naked exploitation of the countries. And that also the people, I mean, I think the leadership in Africa, because it's plain to see that the history of the U.S. in Africa is fraught with things that should tell them we can't be, you know, they can't be trusted. The assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the overthrow of Kwame Nkrumah, I mean, this goes pretty far back. And even now they can see, you know, they're destroying countries like Libya. And so any relationship that presents an alternative that's much more respectful and bilateral is a plus.
Thank you very much for that, Netva Freeman, coordinating committee member at Black Alliance for Peace from Washington, D.C. Abayomi Ezekiwe, thank you so much. Editor at the Pan-African Newswire from Detroit. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikova Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakah.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet, the Messenger of Allah. He was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, with his talents, his genius, and his great endless scientific ability, has proven the luminous reality adopted by the Shia that an imam must be the most aware and virtuous one of the people of his time. And it has also proven that the one who has more knowledge than anyone else must be the imam, regardless of whether he is young or old. Allah the Almighty has provided the infallible imams of the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all, with knowledge, wisdom, and sound judgment, similar to how Allah provided the prophets of the past with these same concepts and qualities. Truly, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam has shown this reality to all of the world.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues and the divine conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam, the ninth divinely appointed Imam. So Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, of course, divinely appointed, meaning that Allah selected His Eminence to be this leader of humanity, this focal point and this access of the cosmos, which is known as an Imam. Of course, beautiful verses of the Holy Quran as well, which talk about an Imam and how it is Allah who Ja'ala, He appoints a Imam. Now, the divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, of course, speaks about many things, and a lot of these things are based upon the conversations and the overall mentality and thought process that the society has in general. Now, when we look at the conversations that are going on in this era, of course, the conversations themselves tell us a lot about the era in which these conversations are taking place. So, for example, we will find that perhaps, 50 or so years ago, before cell phones and these kind of things, the talk of the town was the regular phone that everybody had in their house. And it was quite normal to be memorizing telephone numbers. Yet this is a conversation, for example, of that era. But in this era, we find that if a conversation revolves around modern technology, it's going to be a smartphone or a chip phone or whatever kind of phone is out there that's on the market, and that's what people really will be talking about. And interestingly, nobody memorizes telephone numbers anymore. Now, when we look at the conversations of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam and the people that are asking him questions and the kind of questions that they are asking him, we really get an interesting insight into what exactly was going on in their era. Now, one of the things, of course, which was quite prevalent during the eras of the Imams, and more so, even though right from the beginning, right from Imam Ali alayhi salam's time, this was an issue, but the farther we go from the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam being a center point, being a start point, the farther we go from that start point, the farther we become from that start point. And so here, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, he says that nothing destroys religion like bid'at does. So bid'at is, it can be called an innovation or a heresy or this kind of thing which is put into the religion, which was not in the religion prior to that. So just to explain, the halal and the haram and the mustahab and the makruh, you know, the things that are obligatory, the things that are forbidden, the things that are recommended, the things that are prohibited, better not to do, the things that are neutral, you know, what thing is pure, tahir, what thing is najis, what is impure, all these things cannot be changed. These are fixed. Now, you have something which are these negative bid'ats, and of course, these are things which are included in the religion, which were not in the religion prior to that, you know, and these kind of things are very detrimental. And here, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says that nothing destroys religion like bid'at does. So these innovations which are put into religion, and whether good or bad, they are said to be a part of religion. When they are not a part of religion, this will destroy religion. It seems like a very complicated thing, but I think that as we explained it, it is actually quite simple. The words of the divinely appointed Imam, and so this is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyarat Texts of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
السلام عليك أيها النور الصافي، السلام عليك أيها البدر الطالي.
Peace be upon you, O shining lights. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones. Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Abba Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Ukrainian officials took part in a meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday via video link. An additional €500 million military aid package for Kiev was confirmed, but the EU is at pains to point out that's just a drop in the ocean compared to what the bloc has already provided since last March.
Keep in mind the figure of $49 billion is the total amount of support to Ukraine, military, financial, economic, and humanitarian.
Just a few days ago in the European Parliament, the strategy was condemned.
It's militarism that's driving a dramatic rise in geopolitical tensions, drastically undermining our security. And you'd think that the Ukraine war would have shocked us out of this approach, but no.
Workers have taken to the streets of Brussels to demand peace negotiations.
We need to stop this war because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation.
EU foreign ministers adopted a fresh round of sanctions against Iran on Monday over alleged human rights abuses. The grounds for such sanctions are vehemently rejected by Tehran. Critics say the West's policy towards Russia and Iran is being driven by Washington. Moscow and Tehran control the largest energy reserves in the world. Analysts say the EU's access to these markets is being hampered due to influence from the United States, and ultimately it is ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Also on Monday, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh updated EU foreign ministers on the appalling situation in the occupied territories. There was absolutely no discussion on the EU side regarding possible sanctions against Israel. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The United States suffered its worst mass shooting in nearly a year when a gunman killed 10 and wounded 10 others in California. In the nation's third largest city of Chicago, at least 30 people were shot and 7 killed over the weekend, illustrating how routine gun violence has become across the country. The California gunman showed symptoms of paranoia and mental illness, but for the last 40 years, liberal economic measures have gutted not only health services, but sent jobs overseas, eliminated anti-poverty measures, and fostered a climate of perpetual instability and insecurity.
People feel like it is every person for themselves. And for some people, then the answer to that is going to be, yeah, it's worth the risk. It's worth the, you know, it's worth taking the steps to engage in, you know, I don't know, theft, carjackings, breaking into homes, you know, and ultimately, you know, you're going to have certain situations with that that will create, you know, instances of gun violence and murder.
Last year saw almost double the number of mass shootings compared with just 4 years ago. In 2022, death rates from firearms reached their highest level in three decades. For many big city mayors, even Democratic ones, more cops is the answer. However, anti-police sentiment has exploded, most recently at a protest in Atlanta against yet another killing by police, and many say more militarism just isn't the solution.
Real community safety measures, which does not mean more police within the neighborhoods, but actually means going through building real community bases of support that lean in the direction of violence prevention, but ultimately that can't be separated out from the real needs, you know, of housing, healthcare, education that working people face on the daily.
Following the California massacre, a congressman said that mass shootings are a uniquely American experience. With the termination of many coronavirus-era assistance programs and another recession on the horizon, few expect that such experiences will decrease. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago. United States President Joe Biden has just reached the halfway mark of his term, and perhaps the best word to sum up the past 2 years is a new phrase, polycrisis, which is defined as the simultaneous creation of several catastrophic events. Most of them started with foreign policy. Biden totally backtracked on his promise to re-enter the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy agreement, and then charged into exacerbating the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Sanctions on Russia have backfired so badly that the average family has lost over a month's salary since Biden took office, or $7,400. Biden came to power with total control of Congress, thanks to big campaign promises of rebuilding after the devastation of the coronavirus lockdowns.
The Build Back Better plan that was supposed to give you all these, you know, workers' rights, it was supposed to, like, you know, put so much money into infrastructure, it was supposed to improve the education system. Barely any part of the Build Back Better plan made it past legislation.
Biden's approval rating is currently the lowest of his presidency at just 40%. The Democrats lost control of the lower House of Representatives in the midterm elections due to widespread disillusionment. The country now faces 2 years of congressional dysfunction, and many wonder if the progressive spirit of 2020 can be recaptured.
Every time Republicans have control, they will use whatever power they can, little or a lot, to get what they want passed. Whenever Democrats are in charge, whatever the Republicans left them, they'll cling on to it no matter how far, you know, right it advanced. And so the strategy here is, it's bipartisan if you look at the big picture. The Republicans move things right, they take away all these social and civil liberties, and the Democrats, when elected, preserve just exactly where they are so that when the Republicans win again, they can move them further right.
Record inflation, another recession, a divided Congress, and no end to forever war. The Biden era can't be defined by just one crisis. A recent poll found that 60% of Democrats don't want Biden to run for re-election in 2024. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Afghanistan is witnessing its coldest winter in 15 years, adding to the misery of millions who are already struggling with multiple crises. Umar Khan, a Kabul resident and a father of seven, lives in a cold shack. Two of his children are severely sick. Without a job and relief assistance, he has been unable to afford food, heating, and medication for his family. The situation has triggered fears of human losses.
As I told you, this son of mine collects plastic bottles and waste for one-time heating during the day. I was unemployed almost the entire year, and I couldn't afford fuel or winter clothes for my children. This other son is suffering from the disease of kidney stones. In such a situation, I'm afraid my children may go undernourished or freeze to death. This is a catastrophic moment, and I'm wondering what to do.
Meanwhile, the United Nations has put Afghanistan on its list of 11 crisis hotspots in 2023. The UN survey shows that two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, over 28 million people, need humanitarian aid. Heads of households, like Shah Gul, say they can't cope with the harsh winter alone.
We can't afford more than one meal per day. We used to buy some loaves of bread and potatoes, but today they're also gone from the table. We're not living a life in this cold room with no blanket or enough clothes. When the Taliban took power, everyone was saying that Afghanistan is going to see peace. But what about jobs, earning an income, and food? We need the Taliban administration and aid groups to reach out to us before we die from hunger or cold.
This comes as major aid groups have suspended their missions following the Taliban's ban on female workers. For many Afghans, the services provided by the NGOs were a lifeline that has been removed at the worst possible moment. Afghanistan is grappling with economic, political, and human rights crisis. Experts said the Taliban administration's restrictive measures, coupled with Western sanctions, are worsening the situation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Of high school students have hit the streets of the Italian capital to rally against what they called a school system in grave decay at the service of companies and private interests. The protest took aim at a 2015 school reform named the Good School by then Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. The reform radically transformed the Italian education system, introducing measures including granting more powers to principals, a new national recruitment process for teachers, and obligatory work experience programs for high school students.
The 2015 reform brought private interests into our schools. From that year onwards, the company's interests came first, not our preparation. The rat race had just begun.
The reform has legalized the exploitation of us students. We are obliged to work unpaid for businesses. It's completely useless and unfair.
Students at the rally said the initiative was also called to remember Lorenzo Parrelli, an 18-year-old boy who was crushed by a metal bar while on a school training placement at a factory in northern Italy a year ago.
Lorenzo was assassinated by the work placement program. He was working in a factory for free, with no safety measures in place. Two more people have died under that program and simply in the interest of the capitalistic economy.
Recently, an international family caused a stir by saying they had to leave Italy due to the appalling conditions of the education system. While schools vary around the country, statistics show that educational standards overall are consistently below the EU average.
Italy is the country in the European Union that invests the least in public education. According to data by the European Statistical Agency Eurostat, Italy allocates about 8% of its public spending in this field, placing it last after Greece and well below the EU average of about 10%. Max Civili, Rome.
Women scientists and cultural and high-ranking political figures from 28 countries across the globe gathered in the Iranian capital, Tehran, to celebrate the efforts and achievements of women worldwide in a conference dedicated to women of influence. the first of its kind, an initiative of Iran's first lady, Jamile Alam-ul-Hoda, based on what used to be a ceremony limited to Iranian women in previous years. The conference was aimed at showing appreciation for women of influence while offering support and help for them to grow and promote their ideas, as Ensia Khazali, Iran's vice president for women and family affairs, stated in her opening remarks. With Anna Hakopian, the wife of Armenia's prime minister, emphasizing the important role women play in promoting tolerance and peaceful coexistence. About 300 foreign guests are taking part in this conference, 70 of them female officials and politicians. The conference itself is held in three different levels: cultural, scientific, and a special panel for ministers and first ladies. Morning and afternoon sessions were held to provide a platform for the participants in order to share their ideas and valuable experiences regarding the challenges that women face in today's world. The conference wrapped up with Iran's First Lady thanking her guests for supporting the initiative and a special ceremony where the Goharshad Prize was awarded to seven of the influential women, recognizing their outstanding performance and contributions. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Already in 2023, 30 refugees have drowned in the Mediterranean Sea as they attempted to reach the EU, according to figures from the United Nations. The EU's border and coast guard agency, Frontex, has in the past been lambasted for pushing back unsafe boats, resulting in deaths. On Thursday, the new head of the agency vowed to end this practice.
I am responsible for the fact that my people don't participate in anything called a pushback. So I think that is absolutely clear. That is the legal framework I work in. So that's it.
According to OLAF, the EU's anti-fraud office, at least 2,000 refugees drowned in the Aegean Sea during 2020 and 2021 as they were pushed back from the EU coastline by Frontex. The agency prevented at least 40,000 asylum seekers from reaching the EU, which blatantly breaks international law. In just 10 months, the EU has welcomed more than 4 million Ukrainian refugees. They are afforded all the same rights as EU citizens. However, if you're from a different part of the world, torn up by Western powers, it's a different story. We visited a shelter for Afghans in Brussels.
Before we come in the Europe, we think the Europe care about women, care about children. Now we come in here, not. They don't care about women, they don't care about children.
When the children go to school, they need food, they need clothes. And for everything, we need to work. So we need the job permit.
There are no such problems for Ukrainians. Of course, that's to be welcomed. But rights groups are asking why the discrimination. EU Home Affairs ministers will meet in Stockholm, Sweden next Thursday to agree on a more effective strategy to deport asylum seekers who don't meet refugee status criteria. Campaigners point out there are no plans to adopt a similar policy for refugees arriving here from Western Ukraine, arguably a relatively safe region. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Could the UK witness a renewed push by religious communities to remove a controversial relationship and sex education, also known as RSE lessons, in British schools? It appears the appetite is huge after an online petition on the UK government website rocketed to well over 130,000 signatures in just a few days.
The petition focuses on tackling just one aspect of RSE, which many parents find concerning, LGBT relationship education, which is a lifestyle not condoned by the three Abrahamic faiths. However, there is a growing anti-RSE movement, which is campaigning for the total removal of RSE from the state curriculum, as activists believe that it is parents who should be teaching their kids about this sensitive subject matter rather than state-funded teachers.
RSE is currently mandatory in British schools, teaching kids about relationships and sex education, including same-gender relations. The lessons have been marred with controversy, sparking Muslim-majority parent protests as far back as 2019. Parents alleged their kids were being indoctrinated by secular worldviews
and what they call LGBT propaganda.
We believe that, you know, that the subjects, they should be able to withdraw from this type of subject. So we, the No Outsiders campaign, so we just want to able to have control over what they are being taught.
Speaking to a local Muslim activist, Shakil Afsar explained why he feels the petition received so much support.
I think it would have got a lot more signatures if there wasn't this pro-LGBT narrative in our society where if you speak against them, you are completely shut down, locked up, and the keys thrown away. I think there would have been a lot more. And I think with the people who have signed, they are people who are at the forefront of understanding what's happening. There are many people who don't really understand the situation. They don't even really know what's happening until their children are coming home with these books. I believe that if there was a transparent media, this petition would have signatures in the millions.
So far, the protests have largely received negative coverage, with the establishment refusing to budge on the RSE curriculum. Activists believe this uncompromising stance could boil over to more parent protests in 2023. Robert Carter, London.
Yemenis are growing frustrated with the United Nations' failure to condemn the Saudi-led war on Yemen, or to hold them responsible for the ensued disastrous ramifications. This comes just days after the UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, addressed the United Nations Security Council about the situation in Yemen. While calling for an end to violence, Grundberg declined to condemn the ongoing Saudi artillery shelling that has killed or injured dozens of civilians in the northern province of Sada.
I call on the parties to respect international humanitarian law. Military activity, combined with negative rhetoric and escalatory political and economic measures, create a situation where a simple miscalculation could reignite a cycle of violence that will be difficult.
Grundberg also called for humanitarian aid to Yemen, but mentioned nothing about the lifting of the Saudi blockade, which is the main obstacle preventing vital aid and food supplies from entering the country. This military general we spoke with on the streets of the Yemeni capital says the United Nations is the root cause of all evil in Yemen.
The UN destroys every country they get involved in. Look at what they did in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Sudan. As for Yemen, the United Nations and all of its envoys' efforts in Yemen have been directed at spying on Yemenis, instigating conflicts among Yemenis and fueling chaos and instability.
Some Yemenis are calling on their government to abandon all political talks with the UN. They accuse the UN of complicity with the Saudi-led coalition in the killing of Yemenis. The Yemeni government stated that if the blockade is not lifted and salaries are not paid, the only option left is war. The Yemeni people and government have expressed that the 8-year Saudi-imposed siege on Yemen must be broken by any means necessary. This after years of failed political efforts to resolve the conflict by the United Nations, an entity which most Yemenis lost trust in and accuse of supporting the Saudi military aggression on Yemen. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
There are reports that the Zionist regime's cabinet members have recently gathered to initiate a new wave of demolitions against Palestinian homes. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote in this regard, key Israeli regime cabinet members have gathered to initiate a new wave of demolitions against Palestinians' homes in Area C after a dispute erupted over the rare expulsion of illegal Jewish settlers from a new outpost in the occupied West Bank, the New Arab reported. Far-right ministers reportedly agreed to forcibly halt all new Palestinian building projects in Area C, which accounts for 60% of all land in the West Bank, before they reach completion, according to Israeli media. All major Palestinian cities in the West Bank, including Ramallah, Nablus, Al-Khalil, Beit Lahm, and Jericho, are surrounded by land designated as Area C, seen as essential to any future Palestinian state. According to Israel Hayom, this new phase of land disposition has received the blessing of the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after a dispute between Likud War Minister Yoav Gallant and far-right Bezalel Smotrich, who also holds a ministerial post in the War Ministry. The disagreement came after the Zionist regime army took the rare decision to evict a number of Jewish settlers from an unauthorized outpost in the occupied West Bank erected hours earlier. The move provoked the anger of pro-settler activists and members of Netanyahu's far-right cabinet, including Smotrich, who himself lives in a settlement in the occupied West Bank. Netanyahu issued a statement saying, "The government supports settlements, but only when they are done legally and in prior coordination with the prime minister and security officials, which did not happen in this case." Smotrich had tried to order the army to cancel the demolition of the Wildcat settlement. Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, also living in a settlement, attacked the decision in the Knesset, alleging that the Zionist regime army demolishes more Jewish settlements than it does Palestinian homes. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported that the Zionist regime occupation authorities demolished an agricultural room in East Al-Quds neighborhood of Isavia. According to a local activist, Muhammad Abu Humus said the Zionist regime police accompanying a bulldozer barged into cultivated land isolated by a section of the Zionist regime's apartheid wall in the eastern part of the neighborhood, where the heavy machinery knocked down an agricultural structure. He added that police seized olive and citrus saplings in addition to a water tank. Wafa News Agency also said there are reports that the Zionist regime army has recently admitted its forces have recently killed a Palestinian who posed no imminent danger. The army confirmed that 45-year-old father of four, Ahmad Hassan Kale, was unnecessarily shot dead in front of his son, in front of his 20-year-old son, Qusay, outside Silva town, northeast of the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah, on the morning of Sunday, January 15th. Kahle was one of the dozens of Palestinian commuters stuck in traffic during morning rush hour caused by an army checkpoint erected at the town entrance. He was shot point blank with a single bullet in the neck during a physical scuffle with the Zionist regime troops after the latter forced him and his son to exit their car. Qusay said that he and his father were on their way to work when the troops topped their vehicle shortly after a sound bomb was fired at the car. According to him, it was then when the Zionist troops pepper sprayed the Palestinian father of four and forced him to get out of the car before he fainted. The Zionist media claimed in their initial reports at the time of the shooting that Kahle was shot while allegedly attempting to carry out a stabbing attack. However, following a viral video footage from the scene, the Zionist media edited their article to quote Israeli regime army sources as saying the Zionist troops opened fire after trying to arrest Kahle and that he additionally tried to snatch one of their guns.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries and scholars. I am Atan, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Today we want to talk about Muhammad ibn Ali ibn Shahr Ashub al-Saravi Mazandarani, mainly known as Ibn Shahr Ashub, one of the most outstanding fuqaha, mufassirin and muhaddisin of the 6th century Hijra, and the author of the outstanding works Manaqib ala Abi Talib and Ma'alim al-Ulama. So before getting to his works and his scholarly life, let's be a little bit concerned about his early life and biography, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Ibn Ashub, Ibn Shahr Ashub, his name was Muhammad bin Ali bin Shahr Ashub, and he was from the province of Mazandaran.
Yes.
Which is the northern area of Iran.
Yes.
And which is next to Caspian Sea.
Yes.
He initially, he got his studies, yes, obviously, in his place, in that place. And then, obviously, his father, because he lived in Baghdad as well, so
yes,
he got his education, early education in Baghdad as well.
Saravi refers to Sari in Mazandaran.
Saravi.
That's right. That is the central city of the Mazandaran province now. So Saravim is coming from Sari.
Sari.
Northern part, yes.
He was born in the last decade of the 5th century, which
yes,
was 480s, because there are two dates, either 88 or 89. So there's a one-year difference.
Yes.
Obviously, some of scholars, when they're talking about him, they said that he was born in Baghdad. But mostly, obviously, whether he was born in Baghdad or Mazandaran,
yes,
the main thing is he was one of the famous fuqaha, the jurist. He was the mufassir. He was the historian who have written, the history of Aima alayhi salatu wasalam, and also he was the narrator of a hadith known as Muhaddis.
Yes. We get to his works, as you said, Manaqib Ali Abi Talib and Ma'alim al-Ulama. But Shaykh Rouhani, he also went to Halab, Aleppo. We can say Hamdanids were residing over there. And up to the end of his life, it is believed that he resided over there. Let's talk a little bit about his scholarly life in different cities.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, as you rightly mentioned, Ibn Shahr al-Ashub actually went to or traveled to Halab and Baghdad and different cities.
Yes.
And actually, he taught there and preached the teachings and doctrines of Islamic, let's say, Shiite teachings of Islam, I mean.
Yes.
So, of course, he was so much respected by the people in all those cities like Baghdad, like Halab, like Hilla, in all these different cities that he went and studied there and taught the different students, actually trained different students there. And of course, he had a great, let's say, position and status among the scholars of that time, I mean, in the 5th centuries, Islamic centuries.
That's right. It is believed that he has also was under the tutelage of different scholars, like, for example, Sheikh Tabrisi, we can say Fattah Neishaburi, Abul Fad Ahmadi, Qutbuddin Ravandi. We'll, of course, dedicate our programs to these scholars too, and different students he nurtured, like Sheikh Uddin Abul Hassan, Aliyeb Shorehelli, Ahab al Batriq. You know, these were among the outstanding scholars. But what was Sayyid Mohsen, his main motivation to author the book Manaqib Ali Abi Talib? What does the title mean? And what was his motivation of authoring such a book?
Well, Manaqib is the praise, we can say. Mm-hmm. Manaqib Ali Abi Talib was the praise of the children of Abu Talib alayhi salam. And the main motivation was, since in his time there was a dispute between, you can say, like the Shia school and the Sunni school. And on top of that, since the Wahhabism was growing at that time, and the thoughts, we can say, like, which were against the Ahlul Bayt, the enemies of Ahlul Bayt. Therefore, the Sunni brothers, even who believe in Ahlul Bayt, who had, you know, who had the love of Ahlul Bayt, they even couldn't, they couldn't even talk about the praise of Ahlul Bayt in their time. And on the other hand, we know that there were many things which were written against the Ahlul Bayt at that time. Therefore, Ibn Ashub, Ibn Shahr Ashub, came up with this book, and he wrote this specifically for the praise of Ahlul Bayt, the seerah of Ahlul Bayt, basically, from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam till Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
That's right.
And he aimed it so that the people, general people, when they read this book, they know more about Ahlul Bayt.
Okay.
So this was the main motivation behind writing the, the book.
So this is the main merits, it's to say, of Prophet Muhammad and Sahaba and Aimma, isn't it? But Ali Ali ibn Abi Talib refers to the main descendants of the Qasim Imam Ali alayhi salam. That's right. So what is the significance of this book? I mean, Shaykh Rouhani, why such a book at all must be compiled? Weren't the Muslims on that time aware of the merits and virtues of the progeny of Prophet Muhammad?
One of the historical points that could be mentioned here, and it's really important, is this, that according to the Amawid reading of Islam, because all the Amawid caliphs and kings, actually, unfortunately, they were totally opposed to Ahl al-Bayt, mostly opposed to Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. As you remember that in the history, Muawiyah ordered publicly and officially all the Islamic areas, all the Imam al-Jama'at, that you have to curse Ali ibn Abi Talib in the Jum'ah prayer, in the Friday prayers.
Wow.
It was practiced by those kind of people who were actually the followers of this, let's say, school of thought, I mean, Amawid kind of doctrines and teachings. So that's why just few areas or cities, it's mentioned in the history, they did not curse Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. And also at the same time, the narrations or ahadith which were related to Ahl al-Bayt, to Amir al-Mu'minin, the khulafa of that time and the Amawid caliphs, they stopped the people from narrating any kind of ahadith regarding the merits and fada'il of Ahl al-Bayt and Amir al-Mu'minin. So it paved the ground for a kind of a wrong sort of understanding or misconception about Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam and his children. So that is why the people like Ibn Shahr Ashub in the 5th century,
yes,
of course, they came to this understanding, this conclusion that, okay, something is going wrong,
yes,
in the history of Islam.
Yes.
Because these Amawid kind of people and scholars,
yes,
they very deliberately, very intentionally try mm-hmm. to remove the Ahl al-Bayt or yes. the Ali Ali from the, let's say, Islamic history. While they were the most outstanding people in the history yes. of Islam.
Yes.
So that's why Ibn Shahr Ashub tried to collect mm-hmm. ahadith, narrations, and historical accounts regarding yes. the fada'il and virtues of Ali alayhi salatu wassalam and his children.
Very good.
Yeah, because after the event of Ashura
yes.
and the event of Karbala,
yes.
Very intentionally and purposefully,
mm-hmm.
and the Amawid actually
yes.
dynasty,
yes.
they tried to devalue
oh.
the Ahl Bayt and the Ali Ali.
That's right.
So, of course, unfortunately, it was something that happened. We see that the history, only Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, who was one of the caliphs, very late, I mean, some maybe 8 or 10 decades after the event of Ashura, like that. So then he came to this understanding or this conclusion that
yes.
the curse of Ali should be banned, should be stopped. Because one of his scholars, one of his teachers, when he was a child, he taught him that Ali was the most, we can say, outstanding or the most, let's say, perfect or knowledgeable
right.
scholar yeah, among the companions. Okay. And that now we curse Ali, it's totally wrong.
Oh.
So it was mm-hmm. the reality of the history that Umar ibn Abdul Aziz stopped cursing oh, okay. Ali
that's right.
at that time. So, yeah, of course, I think this kind of works by Ibn Shahr Ashub are very much significant.
Yeah, very significant.
Very much important, because without this kind of books, without this kind of works,
yes.
even nowadays, maybe majority of the Muslims would curse Ali alayhi salatu
wasalam. Yes.
Because it was propagated.
So it is
by
useful,
doctrines,
even nowadays. So many
course,
Muslims
yeah.
can refer to
of
such
course.
Books
yeah.
in order to be more familiar with the progeny of Prophet Muhammad, Imam Ali alayhi salam, up to Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam. That's all right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La
ilaha illallah. So another magnum opus is Ma'alimul Ulama. What is this book, Sayyid Mohsen?
Well, Ma'alimul Ulama is the Book of Rijal. It's
mm-hmm.
it is the book about the scholars or the narrators of the ahadith.
Mm-hmm.
And there is another book with the name of Rijal Ibn Ashub,
mm-hmm.
which Ulama believes this is other than Ma'alimul Ulama.
Okay.
And the main purpose was, since Sheikh Tusi also has mentioned the names of the ulama.
Yes.
In his book, he had the list of them.
Al-Fihrist. Yes.
So Ibn Shahr Ashub, he added 600 more scholars
okay.
into that list.
Okay.
And he pointed out the place where Sheikh Tusi wasn't able to bring the proofs for them.
Yes.
So he added the proofs. As some of the scholars have said, like, this is one of the great works which he has done, especially when he's adding 600 more scholars into the list from the authentic ulama.
Yes.
And not only this, but also he has referred the books which they have written, the works which were done by those ulama. And if there are some works which whose, we can say, like, writers are unknown.
Okay.
He has pointed those things as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a comprehensive, we can say, like, book, which is about the, which gives us the, you know, the science or the knowledge about these writers or the narrators.
Hadith studies
hadith
and, we can say, yes. hadith narrators
studies, which is important because it makes a hadith whether it is authentic or not, isn't it?
Yes.
Even today, for example, Ayatollah Shubairi Zanjani is one of the greatest, we can say.
The supreme leader of Iran, yes, Ayatollah Khamenei, is also, yes. He has specialization in Rijal.
In Rijal.
So basically, this is very important. Why? Because, you know, when we are narrating a hadith from the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, the chain of narrators, they all should be authentic. If we have one person who is a liar, for example, or a person who is a hypocrite, then we cannot have access to the original. Mm-hmm. You know, it is believed that then this is not the actual or the original hadith. There might be changes. Or maybe there is a person who has the habit of, you know, forgetting.
Yes.
Things he has, okay. You know, nowadays we call it
Alzheimer.
Yes.
Alzheimer, that's right.
Sometimes, like now we have this term, but at that time, maybe the one who has Alzheimer or someone who cannot remember,
because, you know,
memorization was very important.
Yes, was very
who cannot remember, or maybe who mix the names, because, you know, all of them, almost they're Muhammad Ibn Ali, for example, or they have the similar names.
Names, that's
how
right.
to differentiate between them. This was very important.
Yes.
And that's why there was an importance of this Ilmul Rijal, this science of men or the Rijal, or narrators. In that time.
That's all right. And Sheikh Rouhani, your final remarks regarding Ma'alim al-Ulama of Ibn Shahr al-Shub.
Yes, when it comes to the importance of this book, we should understand that sometimes, for example, the Shia school of thought is accused of just trusting the, for example, previous generations of these scholars. Sometimes some people might have this misunderstanding, I mean, the opponents and the enemies of the Shayu, that you just trust them while you do not examine, while you do not assess, while you do not evaluate, for example, the teachings or the hadiths and the narrations. While when it comes to this kind of works, when we study this kind of books, we see that even in those early kind of centuries of Islam, our scholars paid attention to the importance of evaluation, assessment of each and every, for example, narrators and scholars. So that's why in order to get the pure, in order to get the truth, or we can say the trustable kind of hadiths and narrations of the Ahlul Bayt. So that's why this kind of works is a kind of examination, evaluation, or assessment of both the texts and also the narrators of these hadiths and sayings of the Ahlul Bayt in order to get access to the truth or to the true kind of narrations and ahadiths of Ahlul Bayt.
That's
why the Shia scholars did not trust, for example, the previous generations of these scholars without any examination. No,
that's all right.
They were very severely, very comprehensively and deeply studied and evaluated and assessed each and every single kind of ahadiths and narrators.
Okay, that's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Ibn Shahr al-Shub passed away on Sha'ban 22nd, a Friday night, in the year 588. In Aleppo, and it is believed that his body was taken into a mountain or a small mountain called Jabal Joshan, which the Shiites of Aleppo believe that it is the burial place of Muhsin al-Siqt, the son of Imam al-Hussein, you know, one of the sons of Imam al-Hussein. It is believed that it is Mashhad al-Siqt or Muhsin al-Siqt, the place. It is believed over there. There is a burial place and burial mausoleum and holy shrine over there. And still, Jabal Joshan, with its old buildings, you know, is searchable on the Google. The buildings were available over there. It is believed that he's Ibn Shahr al-Shub is also buried in that, in the same place. Thank you very much. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir. To another episode and introducing another Shia dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.